Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Even though my specialization in theology is the study of the church's teaching about women, I'm very interested in the topic of friendship. I taught theology at all different levels, including in the high school or secondary school before in the university. And one of the things I realized in my life is that friendship is really central to happiness. And as a moral theologian and as an ethicist, I'm very interested in the question of human happiness. How do we actually flourish? I do not believe God made us to have a life that is dull, uninteresting, and disconnected. I mean, he said, I came that you might have life and have it to the full. You know, and I think that if we're going to live well, the question of friendship is actually more important than we might realize, both divine friendship and human friendship. So this is actually a topic I've studied quite a bit about, and one I like to share thoughts on, and hopefully after the talk, when we have some Q&A, I'd also like to hear what are your questions on it. But I hope that these thoughts gleaned from both Aristotle and St. Thomas will be quite practical to you. I mean, even sometimes people think of philosophy and theology as kind of out there and kind of esoteric, but it's not. I think it's very much about our day-to-day living and our living well. I think sometimes we kind of just go by and we're surviving, but we were meant to thrive. We were meant to live a life that's really full. And I think that if we can rediscover the importance of a friendship, I think there's an important kind of exploration there. So bear with me. This is a little more formal. Those of you who've heard me talk in the past week, this is a little more formal of a lecture than that. But hopefully not, that doesn't formal doesn't mean without great help to your practical and day-to-day living. So in his book, The Primacy of Love, which is an introduction to the ethics of Thomas Aquinas, the author Paul Waddell assesses the dilemma in which he believes we find ourselves. And he assesses it in this way. He says, we know the hunger for friendship. We have been starved for love and affection. We thirst for knowledge and insight, for beauty and wisdom. When I read this comment many years ago when I was writing on friendship, both divine and human, it stopped me in my tracks. Because I find in my many encounters with people I just meet and people I teach that we seem to know that we're hungry and we seem to know that we're thirsty. But I'm not positive we know that the hunger we have is actually for friendship. I don't know if we've all identified it that way. Because I think our culture doesn't say a whole lot about friendship. It's funny, even if I remember when I taught adolescents, young adults, and you know, if I would say something about love, they automatically assumed I meant something about dating and relationships in that level. But very seldom did they think I was talking about friendship. And if you read the ancient philosophers, they actually considered friendship more important and more valuable than romantic love. You know, even if you read the Bible, one of the most famous friendships in the Bible is the friendship between David and Jonathan. And if you remember when King David finds out that Jonathan, his friend, has been killed in battle, he grieves. And it says in the scriptures, he loved him more than he loved women. And it does not mean he had some kind of unusual attraction. It means that friendship was more valuable to him than even the relationships he had on the romantic level, which in our culture, I think, can get sometimes obscured. So I want to kind of invite us to think tonight about, do we recognize that this hunger we have in us includes a hunger for friendship? And what do we do about that? Now, even long before Christ came into the world, when Aristotle was writing his famous book on the ethics, he gave a very significant role to friendship. And he famously wrote a quote that I think is very striking. He said this, without friends, no one would choose to live, though he had all other goods. That's bold. Without friends, no one would choose to live, even if they had all other goods. Now, you might say, wait, you know, is that really true? Is it true that if even if we had every other blessing and every other good thing, but we had no friends, somehow we would feel life is not worth living? Because some people, I think, will say, like, but what about the flip side of that? What if I do have friends, but I still feel like my life is pretty empty? I think this is actually more common in the modern world than we'd like to believe, that there's this kind of feeling that we might call some people in our lives friends, and yet still have this kind of aching kind of emptiness. So what about that? Well, certainly the ancient philosophers weren't talking about kind of passing relationships. They weren't talking about the people you just are around all the time. They certainly weren't talking about social media-based kind of relationships, right? So for Aristotle and the ancient philosophers, to have real, true, deep friendship is an essential part of happiness. But Aristotle made three distinctions about the kinds of friendships we experience, all of us, on our day-to-day lives. And then he kind of comments on what one of those most extensively. So I'm going to walk through what are those kind of friendships, what are their roles in our life, and then what is the most important kind, and what do we need in order to have those kind of friendships? Okay, assuming that we can all buy into the fact that friendship is somehow linked to happiness. So Aristotle said that some kinds of friendship are imperfect, and he puts two kinds of friendship in that category. The first he identifies as friendship of use or utility. Now, in a contemporary sense, you could say, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like friendship at all. If I'm just using another person, that's not friendship, to use someone. But he didn't mean use in the abusive sense. He meant utility in the sense that we have relationships with a lot of people in the day-to-day that are simply useful for both of us. A lot of business relationships are like this. So think about something like a good doctor or dentist, okay? You need your teeth taken care of, right? So you go to a good dentist, and usually you're pretty friendly with your dentist. I mean, this person's going to be drilling in your mouth. You want to be friendly with them, right? Okay. And they expect that you are friendly enough to pay your bills when they come, right? So that you keep your appointment if you set it. So even in a friendship of use, there's some kind of a mutual expectation of, I provide you something useful. So the dentist or doctor provides you a service. You pay your bill or you keep your appointment. That's a friendship of utility, according to Aristotle. But he has said, look, nobody in a friendship of utility expects that that's going to be something beyond what's useful to the two. But it's understood by each party that way. Like, I don't expect my dentist to celebrate my birthday, right? Like, I mean, it's a contractual kind of an arrangement. That's the simplest and least perfect kind of friendship. But it is friendly, right? Okay. Second, he writes about what is called the friendship of pleasure. And I think this one might come up more in our day-to-day living. Now, he did not, again, mean pleasure in the sense of you manipulate or use another person for your own personal pleasure. He's talking about friendship, okay? So a friendship of pleasure is two people share a common activity they enjoy, and that's the basis of the friendship. So maybe they're in a book club together, okay? Maybe they come to TI together. Maybe they play a sport together. Maybe they like the same kind of music and they'll go to musical events. You see what I mean? It's like there's something that you hold in common that you enjoy. And for Aristotle, the friendship of pleasure may be just that. You only see the person at this thing that you commonly and both enjoy, and that's the extent of the relationship, okay? And now, these kind of relationships can grow into what the third one is, but Aristotle is not saying that either of those, the friendship of utility or the friendship of pleasure, is the kind that makes life worth living. When he gets to the third category, this is what he says you absolutely must have to find life worth living, in his view. And actually, Thomas Aquinas agrees with Aristotle on this. And we'll talk about that. The third category is what Aristotle called the perfect or virtuous friendship. Some modern writers who write about Aristotle's friendship theory call it an authentic friendship, okay? But this is the relationship Aristotle thought we can't live without. This is the friendship that he spent the most time discussing. And for both Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, this friendship is one of the most beautiful gifts in life. Why? Because it's by definition a love that is for the sake of the other, not for something you can get from them. Now just think about, pause on that for a second. It's love for another for their own sake, not for what I get from them. already this is a beautiful and very refined kind of friendship, right? Both Thomas and St. Thomas and Aristotle agree that if you're going to have this kind of friendship, the friendship that's grounded in virtue, the friendship that's true, it has to have three specific qualities. So I'm going to walk through those qualities. And they say you can have a lesser, one of those imperfect friendships, the friendship of pleasure or utility, without these three qualities. But to have the kind of friendship that makes life worth living, you need these three qualities. And I sincerely hope as I give this talk that you can hear these and identify someone in your lifetime that you've had this kind of friendship. It's such a beautiful gift. But I will tell you from the beginning, it's extremely rare, okay? We have many, many acquaintances. We have many people we interface with. But a virtuous and perfect and true friendship is something that even the scriptures say, share yourself with many, but make one in a thousand your confidant, right? And they even say in the book of Sirach, a faithful friend is a sturdy shelter. He who finds one finds a rare treasure. That's a word out of scripture, right? The wisdom literature scripture says this kind of friendship is a rare treasure. So what are the qualities that mark this friendship? And I'm going to actually talk about what can we do to cultivate those qualities so that we actually could befriend others better. So the first quality of this authentic, this virtuous friendship is what's called benevolence. Benevolence, okay? It's a word you don't hear a lot in pop culture anymore. But it comes from two Latin roots, okay? Bene and volere. Bene, the good, and volere, to will the good of the other. Benevolence is when you really want what is good for another person, and you want it for their sake. You want them to flourish. You want them to have a truly good life, okay? This, both Aristotle and Thomas would say, is the most important foundation for a virtuous friendship. But in order for us to do this, some things have to be true, okay? To will the good of another requires that we actually know what is good, okay? Now, this is one of the most difficult roadblocks in our contemporary culture because you could debate this with me, but I think in many circles, there's this kind of like, what's good for you is good for you. There is no kind of like shared sense of what's good. And in some sense, that respect for the perceptions of others is helpful. But really to will the good of the other, you have to believe there is a such thing as goodness, okay? And your capacity to will the good of the other matures as you go deeper in your understanding of what's truly good. So what are some things we could kind of agree across many different circles of friends that we might see as a good? For example, we can believe that it's good to know truth. So when we have a friend who wants to study things to improve themselves, we can support this, right? We can say it's good for a person to commit to the things that are important to them. These are strengths. These are things that are good. We can say it's good for someone to pursue healthy relationships. So, you know, sometimes when you're very good friends with somebody, if you see that a relationship is really hurting them, sometimes out of love, you have to point that out, right? And sometimes they're going to get mad at you. Okay, to seek the good of another does not mean that it's always going to go so well. But to will the good of the other is kind of a bedrock for having a healthy friendship. Benevolent friendship can only exist if the people involved in that friendship agree that there are goods they can want for each other. Okay, and I'm going to, so I'll come back to how we can kind of grow in that in a minute. Benevolence requires not only knowing what's good for the other, but both Aristotle and Thomas say you have to also will that good. It doesn't mean you disrespect the freedom of the other, but you actually have to act towards the full flourishing of the other person. So we can speak of this like knowing the good, and we can speak of this willing the good as if they're two, but they're really one in practice. That what I really believe is good for my friend, I'm willing to act towards that goodness. And when Thomas Aquinas talks about this, when St. Thomas says is the virtue that kind of holds those two things together is the virtue we call prudence. That prudence is what helps you know the good, but not just know it, but move towards doing it. So, I mean, if somebody says to you, you know, they always want things to go well for you, but they never do anything to actively help you, you know, you doubt their friendship, right? And in a sincere friendship, you want to know not only that someone wants what's good for you, but they're willing to work towards it. They're willing to do something. And one of the things
Aristotle already pointed out, and then Thomas writes about again, is a real friend is willing to work for your good, even if it's going to cost them something personally. Okay. And this is especially true of if, you know, when two people have become true virtuous friends, if one needs to pursue something that's actually going to take them far away from the friend, right? That it's a test kind of is this a virtuous friendship? Because one of the marks of a virtuous friendship is that I want the good for my friend even more than I want my own good. So Thomas Aquinas writes in his Disputed Questions on Virtue regarding the virtuous friendship. In this type of friendship, it shows greater love to be apart from the friend for his sake, his or her sake, rather than unwilling to give up the person's company even for his own sake. So in other words, I'm willing to like see my friend pursue their good so much, and I want their good so much, that even if it's going to like take them away from me, like I'm willing for them to do that because I believe like their good is what I truly want. So in other words, one of the aspects of a true and virtuous friendship is that you're willing to sacrifice for the good of the other. You know, that's what it is to will the good of the other for their sake more than for my own, which is quite a refined level of love, as you can see. This brings me to the third element, that I have to know what's good. I have to actually want it for the other. The third element of benevolence is that I want the good for the sake of that other. So it's going beyond myself for the other, like I was just mentioning. I think that this is one of the big roadblocks to friendship in the modern culture, because everything kind of tells us, be all about yourself. Take care of yourself. Look out for you, okay? But even though I don't want to bring too many thinkers into this talk because it gets kind of complex, I think it's really interesting that when St. John Paul II, who was very steeped in the philosophy and the theology of Thomas Aquinas, wrote about how humans can really flourish, he always used the word of transcendence. And he said, you have to go beyond self. You know, our world says, make it all about you. Take care of number one, you know? But, you know, if you live that way, you're not going to experience deep flourishing. Like, we were made to go beyond self. And John Paul II would say, it's both vertical and horizontal. You were meant to live for God, and you were meant to live for each other. And the thing is, according to these great thinkers, the more you're capable of going beyond self, the more you're actually capable of being a friend. You know, it's sad. Sometimes you'll meet someone who's very stuck in themselves. And what's interesting is they're technically not capable of really being a friend at that moment. That doesn't mean a good person can't reach out and love towards them, but it won't actually be friendship. You can do altruistic, you can do good things for another. Okay, but you can't have friendship until both parties are mature enough to go beyond themselves. This is one of the reasons I think there's such a crisis in friendship in the modern world. It doesn't matter what age you are. If you're stuck in here, you're not going to be able to befriend another. Okay? And so it's important to recognize these things, I think, to kind of awaken. So if we desire to be or to find, be and find a virtuous friend, what could we do to cultivate a capacity for benevolence, this first quality that marks the virtuous friendship? Well, first I would say we can invest time and energy in learning what the true good is. I assume that coming here tonight, you were interested in learning something about truthfulness that's good. This is great. You're on the path to real friendship, right? We can also develop a capacity for the strength of will by making choices for the good and sticking to them. You know, I think we underestimate, even on the practical level, the value of perseverance. When I was teaching in secondary school, I remember one of my students, I had great students. They were all very hardworking, high performing, trying to get into great universities, wanted to do good things with their lives. And I remember one girl was very overwhelmed. She had way too much going on. She was involved in all these organizations, completely overburdened. And I mean, she's a teenager, so she's got a lot of energy, but she was very overstretched. And I wasn't really thinking that clearly. And I said to her, you know, she named all these organizations she was in. And I said, just drop one of them. And she said, sister, my parents won't let me drop these things because they said, if you give your word and you're committed to something, you need to stick it out. And next time you won't commit to so many things. And when she said, as soon as she said it, I said, you're right. You're right. I was wrong. Please don't listen to my advice. Please listen to theirs. And I said, learning how to stick to a good you've chosen is part of learning how to become a friend. Because let's say, I mean, we've all had friends. And some of those friendships, we went our separate ways for various reasons. But if you're going to be a true friend, you have to learn how to will the good consistently for another. And so that strength of will of when you make a decision to pursue a particular good, following it through to the end, is one of the things that gives you the capacity to be a friend. Okay. Then we can say we also can learn how to foster emotional integrity. That's a phrase I use rather than from Aristotle or Thomas. But emotional integrity is really the way Aquinas would talk about the virtues interplaying with emotion, that our emotions in themselves are not bad, but what needs to happen in order for us to kind of bring them in line with good action is that we need to let them engage with our reason so that we think about the things we feel, that we're not just dropping our friends because we don't feel good about them that day. We're willing to walk the hard walk of even when things are tense, we're willing to have the conversations it takes to preserve the relationship. And that takes a lot of discipline of the emotions, right? So this capacity to look at others, think of their good, be willing to seek the good of others and not my own comfort and well-being all the time, these things are so important. They're very practical things we can do in order to cultivate this. And never underestimate the fact that what's going to lift us to the highest level of being able to live virtuously is divine grace. Like God giving us the gifts. I mean, if you ask God to strengthen your capacity to know what is true, to seek the good of others, to persevere in the good of others, to live more outwardly focused and not just focused on yourself, divine grace is the strongest aid you have in this, right? It can totally elevate all of your powers to be the kind of friend you would like to be. Now, after benevolence, the next quality that both Aristotle and Thomas talk about in virtuous friendship is mutuality. And this, they say, is actually essential. When I was mentioning how if someone's in a space where they're not able to befriend another, you can still do good for them, but they won't be a friendship. That one-sided relationship is because these great thinkers, and I agree, would say friendship by its nature is mutual. So they would say we could be friendly towards many people. And in fact, Aristotle thinks you should be friendly, like in general. He calls it the virtue of affability. I think the Irish have this in spades. Okay, it's just like you're affable, like you're friendly. Like when you come into a place, you have good humor, you know how to relate to people. This is affability. And it's general, it's kind of expanded to many. So we're supposed to be, Aristotle writes, friendly in our manner, our tone, the kind of conversations we have. But in order for two people to enter into the kind of friendship that Aristotle thinks makes life worth living, they have to both exercise benevolence. So again, at times somebody might not be capable of that, and you might reach out to them anyway in the hope that at some stage there could be more mutuality. But how do you find someone who's likely to have the freedom to engage in a mutual friendship? Well, partly choosing to use your whatever leisure or free time you do have in ways that you're more likely to meet people who share a view of a common good with you. You know, it's interesting, activities like the Thomistic Institute, things like going on a service mission trip or, you know, going on a pilgrimage, being part of a church activity. One of the reasons you do this is not to close yourself off to others. It's actually to open yourself to people who likely share a view of what the good is that you would seek for each other. And it's more likely that you would have a virtuous friendship when someone shares a view of goodness. I mean, this is where you're most likely to find those people, and you're most likely to find what's mutual. The third of the essential qualities of virtuous friendship is actually super important. It's called communicatio in the Latin. It's communication, communion, sharing of life is how it's somehow translated. So Aristotle writes in the Ethics that this is the most natural of all desires, that when you want to be the friend of another person, you share your life together. But Aristotle is very specific. He says, look, for animals, they can just be in the field grazing together. He even talks about cows. They can just feed from the same box next to each other. Okay? But he's like, but for humans, he insists that in order for us to become friends, we have to actually share life together, which means especially communication through conversation. Aristotle believes because of our rationality, because of the way that we think and we feel and we express ourselves, one of the most important ways we can become friends is not just by being side by side, but actually sharing our thoughts, our dreams, our hopes. I mean, isn't that what we kind of intuitively understand is what can make a good friend? And it's not, I mean, I think this is, again, one of those places where we might have a little challenge in our contemporary culture, that we had to come to know the person as person. It's not just a quick passing thing. If we stay at the level of the superficial with each other, if we never go beyond pleasant chit-chat, okay, that's never going to become more than the friendship of pleasure or utility. Okay? If it's going to become a virtuous friendship, we have to begin to really know each other. And so we have to be willing to go there with conversations that go beyond pleasantries, right? And you can start with a common interest. A friendship of pleasure can often grow into a friendship that's virtuous. But you need to really share what's in your mind and heart. And I think that it's not only talking about what matters, but meeting the people who matter to that person. I always find it one of the greatest gifts to meet like the family and friends of a person that is my friend. Because it helps you know them. It helps you see them not just as, you know, this passing individual on the streets, right? But as someone who is person. And the more we spend time together, the more we go into the deep things of our thoughts, the more we exchange ideas, hopes, dreams, fears, the more we come to know this person and we go beyond just that superficial to see the goodness in the other, to see the truth of what their being is. And really we come to appreciate the beauty of another human being. And we all know, I hope, from experience, how you can grow in that over time. And so, I mean, what I'm explaining is a very high ideal. And as I said at the beginning, it's not something that comes along every day. A real friendship takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to cultivate. But it's also a big given. I'm always kind of amazed that friendship has a gift nature to it. Many times when I look back at my closest friends in life, I think I can't even often mentally trace when did we become that close of friends. It's like life kind of brought us together, and if we were both willing to take that risk to share what really mattered to us, we became friends somewhere along that way. And it's such a beautiful gift. But it does come to you as gift. It's not something you can kind of demand. So one of the things I want to say about how necessary friendship is in our lives is Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle kind of ask this question. If a person has already become very virtuous, like say you have a very deep prayer life, you're living a good life, is it really necessary for that person to have friends? And when St. Thomas wrote about this when he was writing his commentary on the Ethics and then later in the Summa, he said that for a person who's attained a high level of virtue, the two lesser kinds of friendship are really not as important. I mean, they might be on the practical level be important. Like, obviously, you need people that you kind of have useful business relationships with on a practical level. And you may have the kind of pleasant relationships just because you're social, you're in the society. But St. Thomas wrote this, if we speak of the happiness of this life, not heaven, okay, this life, the happy man needs friends not to make use of them, the friendship of utility, since he suffices them to himself. Like a really virtuous person does find like what they need within themselves, nor to delight in them, since he possesses perfect delight in the operation of virtue. Thomas thought that the more you're virtuous, the more you'll have happiness in yourself. So you'll have less need of a friendship of pleasure or of utility. But he says, if you are already very virtuous, you still would need the virtuous kind of friendship. And he talks about three reasons why you would. I think this is really interesting, that even if you've attained a super high level of virtue, why would you need at least one really good, deep, virtuous friendship? And he gives three reasons. First, so that you, the individual, even if you're very virtuous, would have someone you can do good for. Okay? So like you need to have a friend so that you have someone you can show friendship toward. Because virtue isn't something that closes you in on yourself. It's something that makes you good to others. And so you need this other in order for you to exercise goodness towards them. But he says, secondly, you also need the gift of delighting in seeing your friend do what's good.
Like that there's a part of your humanity that's deeper when you rejoice in the good of another. I don't know if you've had this. It's a very unique and beautiful quality. A person who can rejoice in the good of another as if it were their own joy. It takes a great deal of spiritual maturity, actually, to be able to rejoice in the good of another as if it were your own good. But he says this is why the virtuous person needs a friend. And then thirdly, that he may be helped by that friend in doing his own good work. So he says, look, you need someone you can do good towards. You need someone that when you see the good they do in their life, you rejoice in it. And then someone that helps you to do the good. You know, this is what a real friendship is. Someone who draws out the best in you. Someone that wants you to be your best person and they're trying to be their best person. Now, one of my favorite books on the different loves of the heart and why we need all different kinds of love, including friendship, is the book by C.S. Lewis, The Four Loves. If you ever read this book, C.S. Lewis talks about the fact that the first love we all encounter when we're born into the world is the love of storge. It's affection, the affection that you experience within your family. Okay. And he says that this is a very important love. It's the love, but he says, look, this is the love you're born into. Okay. Like, and you may experience a very strong experience of that or not, like depending on what your family life was like, your affections. And then he talks about the fact that there's also romantic love, eros, that you're drawn out towards others and this kind of ecstatic moving out beyond yourself at the romantic level. And he talks about agape, the love that's very disinterested, like Christian love, the love that would lead you to serve, the love that makes you a good person. But in his discussion of friendship, he agrees with those in the ancient world that this is a very unique kind of love, and it's a love that's essential to human happiness. But he makes this observation, and Lewis is always such a kind of brilliant writer. He says this about friendship. Those who have nothing can share nothing. And those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. I'll repeat that. Those who have nothing can share nothing. And those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. Now, this is Lewis's comment on friendship. So, if we want to have the capacity to truly befriend another, we have to actually have a self to share. And that's why I think, in a sense, you have to have a prayer life in order to be a good friend. Because you have to come to know who you are. And there's a sense in which you come to know who you are most profoundly in relation to God. But John Paul II would call this self-possession. He said, you can't give of yourself if you don't even know who you are. Because you have to have a self to give. And if you're into Lewis's fiction, I think his most brilliant of all novels that he wrote was Till We Have Faces. And in that book, he has the main character, or Queen Orwell. She's just a fascinating character. She's a queen. And she's over this whole realm, but she really doesn't know herself because all her life she's been put down because she wasn't a boy, because she is physically ugly, and because her father, the king, always tells her she's worthless, basically. And so she ends up spending her life feeling like just like she's no one and nothing. And she's always kind of jealous and envious of her sister Psyche in the book, who's beautiful. Psyche is beautiful, and everyone wants to love Psyche because she's beautiful both inside and out. She's a good person, Psyche. She's virtuous. She's loving. And Orwell, this is a novel. It's based on the myth of Cupid and Psyche. It's a marvelous work. But it takes her an entire journey, and I don't want to ruin all, but without spoiling it too much, she has to come to see herself for real. Because Orwell thinks that no one will ever love her, that she'll never have a true friend, and that no one will ever respect her. And certainly she feels like she'll never be loved as a wife because she just thinks she's so worthless that she hides herself. She literally covers her face so that no one can see her. And I think we live in a moment in time where so many voices in our culture, so many things around us tell us that we're really not worth loving. We're really not worth the time of others. And that can be stuff in our own heart. It can be wounds. It can be things in the culture around us. And Lewis has this amazing line when Queen Orwell is finally beginning to see herself for real and not all the negativity that's been in her mind and heart her whole life. And this kind of brilliant line that gave the novel its title comes at the end where the line is,
how can we see the gods face to face until we have faces? And I love the line because I'm like, how can we see anyone until we have faces? If C.S. Lewis is right, if we have nothing, we can share nothing. If we're so unaware of our real selves, if we're always kind of shifting, how do we befriend? You cannot be a friend to another unless you have a self to give, a self to share. And when I was a younger woman, before I was a sister, I remember my mother saying to me, one time I was kind of going out with a group of friends, and I had been with a different group of friends earlier, and she said, you know, sometimes I wonder who's the real you. And I mean, it kind of stopped me in my tracks. And she said, when you're around this one group, you act a certain way. And when you're around another group, you act a different way. And she's like, who are you really? And it was such an important question in my life because I had to stop and say, no, who am I really? Like, why do I change when I'm around different people? What is my face? Who am I? Like, do I want to be the person I am when I'm with that crowd? Do I want to be the person I am with that crowd? Or neither of the above? And I started to realize that it's not an uncommon thing in humanity that sometimes we're so striving to kind of just fit in where we are with the people we are that we haven't even found who we are yet. And then until you find who you are, I agree with C.S. Lewis, how can you share when you have nothing to share? You have to define yourself first. And actually, I think this is one of those things that we bypass, not only in friendship, but in romantic relationships. I think sometimes people just think you're going to define yourself in the other. And I'm like, there is only one other that you can encounter to really find yourself. And this is an other with a capital O. Okay. That I do believe real prayer puts you in contact with the God who made you. And it makes you more aware of who you really are. And if you think about your human relationships, which are the ones that when you're in the presence of that person, you actually are not self-conscious? I hope you all have at least one person that when you stand before them, it's your real face. You know, I mean, I would say if you can identify that person, that's probably your closest friend. Who's the person that when you're with them, you're you? You don't have to filter what you say. You don't have to filter what you think. You can just be who you are, but they also inspire you to want to be your best self. I was grateful my mother said to me that many years ago, because actually that became a turning point in my life when I started to realize I don't want to be just the projection of whatever group of people I'm with, and I'm just trying to please them. I want to be me. I want to know who I face. And when I found myself more fully, I actually found my vocation as well. Because I was the real me. Like, where could I flourish? Where could I be myself? Where did I not have to put on a show before anyone? And this is what I hope for all of us. Like, so if Lewis is right, you have to have a face. You have to know who you are to be able to share. But you also have to be going somewhere to have a fellow traveler. Knowing, part of knowing yourself, and actually a significant part of knowing yourself, is knowing your destination. Okay? So if you don't know what your life is about or where you're headed, now I'm not saying we have to have every question answered, but when you figure out what life is about, where you're heading, what's important to you, why you value what you value, then you can find a fellow traveler. And this is why it doesn't mean you can't have friends who have different value systems than you, but your best friend and your best friends, if you have more than one, will be somebody who shares the destination and knows they share the destination, right? And the higher the goal that you share in common, the more you walk the journey together, right? And so someone who knows the most about the destination that you share of you with is going to actually have the most capacity to walk with you that destination. And I can say that in truth, like when I was discerning my own vocation, I had a lot of different friends. And we were friendly on all different levels of the three friendships here. the utility, the pleasure. A lot of my friends were friendships of pleasure. Like we enjoyed the same kind of music. We enjoyed going to art galleries. We enjoyed just the kind of reading books together, talking through things. But interestingly, if we had different views of the destination, they had different capacities to want my good. For example, one person I called a friend when I told him that I felt called to give my life to being a sister, he said, "What a waste of your entire existence. What a waste." And it wasn't that he was a bad person. It was that we didn't have the same final goal destination, right? I had another friend who didn't believe in God,
But he believed that there was a good way to live, an ethical way to live. And when he heard that I wanted to dedicate myself, he was like, well, that's a beautiful thing, right? It's a good thing. Like, he didn't quite understand it, but he was like, well, it seems like you'll be serving people. That's good, right? Whereas, you know, I had other friends who we enjoyed each other's company, but they weren't quite there with looking at the final picture. And so they were like, wow, this is hard. You're going to go away. I'm not going to see you. Like, and like the friendship kind of fractured a bit, okay? But I had a friend who understood it completely and who said, I've always only wanted you to be happy. And if this is where you have to go and what you have to do to be everything God made you to be, I want you to go, even though it will break my heart to lose you in my day-to-day life. That's the friendship that Aristotle was talking about. This person wanted my good so much that they were like, I wouldn't hold on to you to keep you from something God wanted for you, because that's where you're going to find happiness. That's where you're going to be everything you were made to be, right? That's the kind of friendship that I think Aristotle was talking about, the one that we can't live without, the one that it's like, and it is a rare treasure. Of all the people I've known in my long life's journey, there are very few that I would say that's the kind of friendship that we have. Now, one of the most striking differences between the way Aristotle in the ancient world saw friendship and St. Thomas saw it is in their understanding of the middle term. I said, benevolence, wanting the good of the other, absolute bedrock. If you don't want the will the good of the other, you can't be a friend, okay? The sharing of life, the communication of good has to be there. Where they're most different between Aristotle, the very virtuous pagan philosopher, and Thomas Aquinas, the great saint, is in their concept of mutuality. This is very interesting. Neither of them denied that friendship had to be mutual, but Aristotle had a very limited understanding of the mutuality of friendship. He thought there were very few people who could truly be friends because he thought they had to be on the same like educational level, socioeconomic level. Like he didn't think like somebody who's in a high position, like your boss and an employee, could be a friend. He didn't think really men and women could be friends. And he certainly didn't think that God and the human person could be friends. Because even though he was raised in the context of many gods, he did believe that it was most likely there was one God. but he didn't think that that God could be the friend of humanity. So here's where Christianity takes a really interesting turn, both on the divine and the human. Because St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, living after the coming of Christ, long after the coming of Christ, has in this point something revolutionary about friendship. Because Aristotle thought you can't be the friend of God because there's this infinite gap between God and the human person. So how could there be mutuality between us and God? And even socioeconomically, like some people are just so far apart. There's no way you could speak of mutuality between those, according to Aristotle. But Thomas is a true Christian. So when St. Thomas sees the revolution that came through Jesus Christ coming into this world, what he realizes is the incarnation, Jesus Christ, God becoming man, is now the total game changer. Now the human person can be the friend of God. Why? Because God became man. God became one of us. God walked this earth. And you know, if you read the what Jesus himself said to his closest friends, I no longer call you servants, I call you friends. Because a servant doesn't know what his master is doing. You know, some people have a very servant relationship to God. You know, like, I just have to do a lot. I have to please God a lot. He wants us to be his friends. And what does he say? A servant doesn't know what the master is doing, but a friend does. And I have revealed to you all that the Father has revealed to me. One of the major revelations of Jesus Christ is that you are called to be the friend of God. You are called to know the secrets of the inner life of God. That communion of life that I said is necessary for friendship, then now you can actually through prayer attain that. So you can be the friend of God. And this radically transforms also human relationships. Because if you read Christianity and read it well, now there is no limit to who could be your friend. Because in Jesus Christ, we are truly brothers and sisters. We are truly put on a par. If you don't believe me, like read, you know, there's this very short book in the Bible that like almost nobody reads, the letter to Philemon, okay? And it's about somebody who had been a slave, kind of like St. Patrick, and someone who had been enslaved and now is going back to the person who had once owned them. And St. Paul says, you're a Christian now. He's a Christian now. He baptized Philemon. He's like, now you are brothers in the Lord. Now it's no longer master-slave relationship. Now they can be friends and treat him good for my sake. He actually calls on them to like treat this person well for his sake, to do the good for the sake of his friend. And now to see master-slave doesn't exist anymore. You know, that's when St. Paul writes about the fact that in Christ, there is no male and female. He's not saying we aren't men and women. He's not saying, you know, there is no master-slave. He's not saying that social categories don't exist. What he's saying is, if you understand who you are in Jesus Christ, you see that you are capable of a mutual love to anyone, anyone. There's no barrier, you know. And I would say, especially for married couples, which Aristotle didn't have much of a view that there could be friendship there, I would say it's most essential that two people who spend a life together have actual friendship. It's very beautiful. My nephew, when he dated the same girl all through high school, and then after they graduated high school and were into their like college years, and they kind of just realized they loved each other. It was like they had been such good friends that they didn't even realize that it was love. And then eventually they got married and they have a family together, and they're very on one page. They're very have the same goals. They kind of have this great common walk together. And I was like, he married his best friend. Like this is, and his brother, who never says anything serious, he's just a total cut up in the family. His brother said one day, if I'm ever going to get married, I hope my marriage is just like that. And I said, then find the girl who's your best friend. And he did. Years later, many years later, he married his best friend. And you know, it's really beautiful that, you know, in Christ, all these categories that people felt kind of made it impossible for true friendship to exist, they can exist and we're called to. Why? Because in the light of the gospel, we're all the children of the Heavenly Father. We're all brothers and sisters in Christ. We're all capable of friendship with one another. So I think this revolutionizes our ability to be friends. So how do we become the best friends we can? Well, by learning how to seek the greatest and highest good. Because if by definition, friendship is to will the good of the other, the more I'm striving for the greatest goods in my life, the more I have the capacity to befriend another. Because if Lewis said those who have nothing can share nothing, and those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers, the reverse is also true. Those who know and long for the best and greatest good have the most to share. Like the higher your sense of what the good is you're living for, the more you have to share. And those who are the most sure of their destination can be the best fellow travelers. You're like the most equipped to befriend another. So I just recommend, like, if we want to be able to be the kind of friend we would like to find, we walk in God's grace, learn how to have a prayer life, a real prayer life. I mean, I think if you learn how to be the friend of the Lord, it's so powerful, you know, and I'm no one to judge anyone. I remember distinctly the day in my life that I met a priest, that the day I met him, I looked at him and I said, that man walks with the Lord as his very best friend. And I wanted to just like mentor with him because I wanted to learn how to like know Jesus like that, like that he was like a real part of my life, a real part of my heart. I received my understanding of myself through the love that God has for me. And it changed everything about me. It changed the way I prayed, it changed the way I see myself, and it changed the way I see other people. So to have a prayer life awakened to true faith, hope, and charity, this is the best preparation for friendship. And St. Thomas Aquinas says that it begins in this life by grace, which grows in us through our prayer, our sacramental life, but that it's only perfected in glory. He said, you'll be the best friend when you're in the kingdom of God, which is why the church actually encourages us to be friends with the saints. You know, it's interesting, you come into a Catholic church, there's all these saints, there's all these images of the saints to remind us that there are people who've gone before us, but who actually are very capable of being friends. Now you might say it's on a spiritual level, right? Because they're not physically here walking. I love these photographs of the saints up here because like they're real people. They're not people who are like you were making up. These are true people who walked in this world and they're capable of befriending us because they want us to become to where they are. But we need both, I think, our heavenly friends and the friends that are sharing this journey with us. And really, ultimately, the best friend we will ever find. And if we learn to be the friends of the Lord, I think we will be a better friend to every person that we're called to be friends to. Because he alone, Jesus Christ, knows the full truth of where we're headed,
wills our good to the very end. He poured himself out completely for us. Okay? I mean, he said in his own teaching, there's no greater love than to lay down your life for your friends. You know, and he didn't just say it, he did it. And I do believe that if we are grounded in that relationship, our capacity to seek the good of another, to know what's good for another, to seek the good of another, and to do it, to will it, will be lived at its fullest. And I just encourage you, I think that this teaching that comes from centuries and centuries ago about the gift of friendship in our life is part of what Jesus said as his own mission statement. I love John 10:10 is one of my favorite verses of the Bible because I call it the mission statement of Jesus Christ. I came that you might have life and have it to the full. I don't think we were meant to drag around just barely surviving. I think we were made to thrive. And I think that friendship is absolutely essential to our human thriving. So I return to what I said at the beginning. If Aristotle wrote, without friends, no one would choose to live, though he had all other goods, then let's flip it. With friends, wouldn't we all want to choose to live, even if we had no other goods? And I believe that that's true. So thank you for your attention, and hopefully this is helpful for your own journey and friendship. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.